Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 138 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, I don't think 2022 has started out quite the way many of us hoped. And so as the first podcast of the year, I thought I would do something all by myself and just a little bit fun, hopefully, about Dungeons & Dragons. Now, I have to say, I haven't played Dungeons & Dragons for decades. And that is because I was never a person who was all that into it. I did play it, and I played it because it was something that my brothers and I did together. Although I was the one who spent hours creating my character. It was usually the same. I was usually an elf rogue, I think. And then by the time I was finished creating my character and doing all that rolling and deciding, I didn't actually want to play, so I didn't play all that much. And I think my brothers have forgiven me by now, I hope. We had a good time at Christmas, so hopefully they've forgiven me for that. So if I make mistakes, Dungeons & Dragons followers, I hope that you'll forgive me. What I wanted to do this week was kind of talk about the ways in which you can use the real Middle Ages to inform Dungeons & Dragons. And this was inspired by a guy who emailed me to ask me about wizards. So the question that I got emailed was, if there was a real wizard in the 14th century, what would they wear? And so this kind of got me off thinking about what kind of things could you use from real life to inform your D&D games and make them perhaps more exciting or more realistic. I know that this is a game that a lot of adults are playing now, and maybe following the rules that are kind of constricted by reality might make it more interesting and more fun for you. So here are a bunch of details that you might want to throw in when you are creating your next D&D game. So I'm thinking this is more of a DM's guide, a dungeon master's guide, but it could be something that could be fun for players too, especially if they want to work around their DM. So for people who are not into Dungeons & Dragons, I have a whole bunch of interesting trivia about the real medieval world for you. So this is still going to be a fun episode for you, I hope, filled with all sorts of the type of trivia that maybe we would have said at cocktail parties back in the pre-COVID days, but maybe you can text your friends about if you have to relieve the boredom of quarantine. We'll see. So when I think of Dungeons & Dragons, there are three things I think of in terms of history that can inform it. When I think of Dungeons & Dragons, I think of equipment, I think about travel, like quests, and I think about traps. So let's start with equipment, and let's start with a question that got this started. So what would a wizard wear if wizards were real in the 14th century? And thinking about this, I had to think about this pretty deeply, I think. When I think about a wizard, what I'm thinking about is somebody who is a scholar, right? Somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about subjects in depth. So to me, a wizard, if they were real in the Middle Ages, would be a scholar. And so what they would be wearing would be a kappa. There's more about this in M.J. Toswell's book, Today's Medieval University. But a kappa is something that you'd be wearing as a cleric. So everybody's educated by the church in the real Middle Ages. So they are wearing clothes that speak to that. So you'd be wearing a black kappa, which is a sleeveless gown that is lined in miniver or ermine, so fur linings. So shout out to the people who graduated in the 20th century. We have some graduation pictures in my family of people who were wearing a black robe with miniver around it. So this might be a familiar robe to you if you are somebody who has seen these pictures from graduations past. So a scholar is going to be wearing a big old robe, usually in black. Now, I have seen scholars in manuscripts wearing other colors as well. You might see them in scarlet as well, or violet. And in Margaret Scott's book, Fashion in the Middle Ages, she has pictures of scholars wearing scarlet robes. And she suggests that these are people who have doctorates, so PhDs, and that medical doctors would be wearing violet robes. And in these manuscript images that she has from the 14th and 15th centuries, the kappa or the robe that they're wearing has sleeves. So in the earlier ones, perhaps they don't have sleeves. In the later ones, it might have sleeves. Either way, they're wearing a big old gown, kind of like you'd still see in graduations today. On their heads, they wouldn't be wearing a pointed hat. They might be wearing the hood that's attached to the gown, so it would be lined in white fur. Or they might be wearing a regular hat, or a hat that looks kind of like a mortarboard, or kind of a skull cap. And that would probably be matching what they were wearing. So if they were very scholarly in terms of theology and like really into the church's teachings, they'd probably be wearing just black, or they might be wearing scarlet if they want to show off that they have a PhD. Now, if you're a wizard, it's likely, I think, that if we're kind of veering off from reality into fantasy, that you might actually be one of those wizards who decorates your robe with arcane symbols. And we know that in the Middle Ages, scholars were really invested in stuff that we might think of as arcane now. So they were really interested in astrology, and they studied it as seriously as astronomy. So if you are a wizard back in the day, you might very well have the signs of the zodiac embroidered on your gown if you're going to be blingy. That could be something that you could do. Other things that you might have on your gown might be Arabic. Latin was the language of education, but the Arabic sources were the ones that had all sorts of the information that scholars were interested in Europe in the Middle Ages. So things like calculus, you'd be learning from Arabic sources, or medicine, you'd be learning from Arabic sources. So Arabic writing was kind of cool. It was elevated. And one of the things that you can see in some Persian art and Arabic art is mirror writing as well. So you sometimes see this on artifacts in Western Europe because it just looks kind of cool. It was cool decoration, even if the people who had it on their own cups sometimes or tapestries, they might not actually know what the Arabic mirror writing is saying, but it looks cool. So if you're a wizard, you might have this on your robes as well. You might also have Viking runes because those look very cool. And most of the people in the later part of the Middle Ages can't read runes anyway. So you might have these embroidered on your robe. So there you go. If you're a wizard in the real Middle Ages, or if you're a D&D wizard, leaning on the real Middle Ages, you might have a decorated robe using arcane symbols, which I think is pretty cool. Now, here's a little bit of trivia for you. Something that D&D made very popular was the word paladin. And so you see paladins across video games and other role-playing games and just fantasy in general. And paladins are usually warriors that have some sort of special power, some magic, and is often related to divinity. So they might have a god that's similar to one that's in the real world, or they might have a god that's complete fantasy, but their power is kind of magical and it comes from divinity. Now, paladin's a real word. It referred to, at least from what we can tell, early on it referred to the people who were supporting Charlemagne. So not just anybody, not just regular supporters, but those peers who were lords who were supporting Charlemagne. So they didn't have any divine power, although that would be really cool. But Charlemagne was one of these people who was really into military excellence. So a paladin could have military excellence. He could be a good counselor in military matters. And Charlemagne was also really into the divine. He was somebody who really tried to make sure that religion as was practiced in his empire was consistent and was reputable. So a paladin now, if you look at any definition, it might have a sort of knightly but also magical element to it. But paladin back in the day wasn't magical. So I thought it's an interesting bit of trivia for you. It comes to us kind of directly from Dungeons and Dragons in the 70s, but it's paladin is a word that's used quite a lot in fantasy now. So in terms of equipment, it depends on where you really start your Dungeons and Dragons quest. You can start it anywhere, really, because it's your own fantasy, it's your own game. But when your people are stocking or restocking, or they need to get equipment, they might go to a city. They might go to a town, or they might go to a city to get this done. So I thought this might be interesting for a dungeon master to think about, because there are always ways that you want to ambush your characters, or you want to ambush the people who are playing and make things difficult for them. So getting your equipment, you can make a little bit more difficult for the players, in that medieval cities in real life were laid out where you had like with like. So you had the same trades in the same street. So Paris is a good example of this. The Latin Quarter is still called the Latin Quarter. I talked about this on a previous podcast because that was the area of Paris where all the students were and they all spoke Latin. So that's still the Latin Quarter. That's where all the students were. You also had streets called Paternoster Row in Paris, and that's where you would have all the clerks. It was kind of close to the cathedral. You would have parchment there. You would have all the places you could get quills and ink. You would have bookbinders. all around the same spot. So if you think of this in terms of any medieval city, you have like with like. So you have all the tanners in one place, all the fabric merchants in one place, all of these things kind of separated out into different spots. I mention this because if you have a team that's hopefully got different skills and different needs, if they go to a big city, they're going to have to split up, or it's going to take a day or two to get all of their stuff because they might be on foot or they might be on horseback and it could be a slow ride through the city, but they might have to split up to find the things they want because you're not necessarily going to find wizard stuff next to armory stuff. So that's one way that you can use as Dungeon Master to split up your players and maybe ambush them in different ways. It's something that I think is cool when you think about all of these practicalities, like how can I spring a trap on people? Well, the real Middle Ages gives you a bunch of things you can do, like splitting up your people in the middle of a city. Cities are also where you're likely to get the best stuff. So in a small town, you will have a merchant that's selling grocery items, and you'll have probably one blacksmith, maybe two blacksmiths, depending on the size of the village. And that blacksmith can furnish you with axes and stuff like that. They could probably sharpen your weapons, but they're not the place to get the best weapons or the most specialized materials. You get that stuff in the city. So what kind of stuff can you get in the city that's harder to get in a village? Well, a city is where you get all the international trade stuff more easily. And spice is something that I think is underestimated, and it could be something that you might find useful in your game as well. Instead of carrying around all this heavy clinking gold, you might carry spices around to trade or to eat. They could be very useful, especially if you come across perhaps a different species. I know that in Dungeons & Dragons you have things like orcs and trolls and things. You might be able to share spices with them. That could be something that is a good option for you. And of course you find more of that in cities. You also find more cloth and textiles in cities, so it's easier to furnish a disguise, which might be something that you have to do, or to find something like a waterproof cloak, depending on where your quest takes you. All of that stuff is easier to find in cities. You can also fence stuff more easily in cities. And we know that not everybody in Dungeons & Dragons is necessarily good, right? You have that spectrum where you could be like chaotic good or lawful good, but you could also be chaotic evil. So if you are somebody who needs to fence goods, you can do that more easily in the city. Something that you can get most easily in a city and not in a town is kind of what I'm getting at already, and that is the best blades. Because a blacksmith doesn't normally make a sword by himself. You want to find a swordsmith, you want to find an armorsmith, you want to find a cutler, somebody who can make you a blade or some armor that's specialized. So you can find this in a city, or you can find it near a castle. One of the things that people ask about is, can I make an arrow by myself? If my character's off questing, that fiction writers ask me this question, as well as people who are working with fantasy in other ways, can I make my own arrows? And the short answer is not really. Arrowsmithing is difficult. It requires a forge, an anvil, some tools. It requires the flight feathers of a bird. So not just any feathers are going to do it. You need the flight feathers of a bird. You need iron. You need glue. You need all sorts of stuff. Not only that, but you also need the skill to put it all together. So it's not something that you can do easily by yourself. You could create arrows with like stone, but it's not going to be easy. And they're certainly not going to be good arrows. So the best thing you can do is to find an arrowsmith in the city, and hopefully they will furnish you with some arrows. You want to get as many as you can, and you want to take care of them and also not use them recklessly. So if you're trying to build your D&D game around reality, you're going to have to kind of ration your arrows. The other question about arrows is, can you get them on a battlefield? Yes, sometimes. You might find some that have fallen and not been broken. You might find some that have been stuck into people and you can get them out. Perhaps the fletching is undamaged, but it's unlikely. And part of the reason for that is you do get damage when an arrow flies and hits something, of course. But another reason is the arrows are often attached to the shaft with fish glue. And this is something I talked about with Matthew Bennett. I sat next to him at a conference and asked him this question because I had come across somebody at a festival that said medieval people, you know, kept their arrowheads in a bag full of gross stuff so that they could quickly slip it onto the shaft and shoot it and use it for biological warfare, which is absolute nonsense. So I was asking Matthew Bennett about arrowheads, and he mentioned that they're attached with fish glue. And one of the things that happens is when this arrow goes into a person or an orc, the fish glue heats up and you might be able to pull the shaft out, but not the arrowhead out. So this is another reason why it's difficult to actually pick up arrows from a battlefield, especially if they're in a creature or a person, and reuse them. They might be damaged and you might actually have a lot of difficulty getting the arrowhead out. So again, while you're in the city, pick up a bunch of arrows and use those arrows. And if you're somebody who's writing fiction, maybe Robin Hood fiction, remember this when you are equipping your heroes. Now, what is a cool thing that's a bit of a one-stop shop is the apothecary shop. And you might not think about this too often. Apothecaries are people who give you medicine, or if you're Romeo, they give you poison, but only because they are poor. One of the things that's interesting about apothecary shops is they are people that have all sorts of really cool ingredients. So they might have spices that might be where you get your spices from. They'll have things like honey. They'll have things like wax. And they put these things together not only to make medicine, but to make cosmetics and to make ink. So one of the things I talk about in my book, Life in Medieval Europe, is the apothecary shop is kind of like a modern drugstore. You can get paper there, ink. You can get cosmetics, you can get possibly deodorant, and you can get your medicine there. So these are all things that you can equip yourself with at the apothecary shop. And they do have these at smaller villages as well, but of course you get the better ones in a city. A city is also where you can pick up food. Of course you can pick up food in smaller villages, or you can gather it along the way. One of the things I think is most useful about Dungeons & Dragons is there's magic in it. And I would definitely be a person who would be using magic to cook, because everything that you cook in the Middle Ages takes a lot of time. But in the city, you can pick up pre-made food, which is great. If you have a bakery you can go to and get a whole bunch of pasties and put those in your bag, you might want to do that because you can eat those hot or cold along the way. You don't have to take the time to cook. But really, if you're doing a Dungeons & Dragons game, you're creating a character, give them magic enough to cook, because it will save you so much time if you're trying to stick to vaguely realistic scenarios. And the last thing that I want to mention about food is, if you're sticking again to reality as much as possible, I talked about how in cities they have like with like. So if you are in a bigger city and you have a character that needs kosher food or needs halal food, you can find that in a city, not easily in a village, depending on which part of the world your game takes place in. So moving on, the next thing I think about when I think about Dungeons & Dragons, I think about equipment, I think about travel, and I think about traps. So we are on to travel. So if you have got all this stuff, again, we're vaguely holding on to reality here, although a magic bag of carrying would be very helpful this time. How are you going to carry all your stuff? Now, in the medieval manuscripts that I've seen, most of the time, a backpack is kind of like a wicker basket that has straps on it, and it's open at the top, so it looks much like a regular basket, but with a bit of a flat back that can stick on your back and not be as uncomfortable. I've never seen a leather backpack of the type that we use now in a medieval manuscript. That's not to say they don't exist, but I've never seen one. So it's less likely that people had those very often. But they would have a satchel, or most of the time they would carry stuff on their belt. So if you have a lot of stuff, you want to think about it kind of like Batman. How can I carry this on my belt? Because that is how people carried it most often. And it's also the most secure. It's harder for people to steal stuff from you if it's attached to your body. These wicker sort of backpack things, in medieval manuscripts, I've seen people carrying everything from firewood to grapes to toddlers in them, so they can be quite sturdy. They don't keep a lot of the rain out, but they do drain pretty well, so that's a good thing. If you have something that's important to carry around, you might want to have a leather satchel that's waterproofed. And magic, again, will help you with this as much as possible. Other things that you need to carry with you. Well, if you are not magical and you're cooking, you need to have pots with you. You need to have dishes, spoons. These things can be made of metal or horn. They could be made of wood. So they could be light or they could be heavy. It really depends on how important appearances are to your character. You also need to carry flint and steel, because if you're not magical, you need to make your own fire. And you need that because not only do you need it to cook, but everyone in every medieval Dungeons & Dragons game that I've heard of always goes into a cave. There's always a cave, right? So you need to have flint and steel, and you probably need to have the stuff to create a torch with you, or candles with you, or lanterns as well. Don't forget, you need to carry your food and you need to carry your water. If you're traveling, you need to have fresh water. Always think about a water source. When you don't have taps to hand, water becomes super important. Anyone who's ever watched a survival show on TV knows this, right? If you're a wizard, you might have a spell book with you. That would be really cool to have with you for a couple reasons. First of all, to help you cast your spells. Secondly, because books are always pretty good at holding their value. So if you need coin, you can sell your book. They don't necessarily have to be fancy, although fancy ones will get you more money. They could also have a soft cover made of leather or another piece of parchment, and you could just kind of roll that up and toss it in your bag. So it doesn't have to be heavy, but if it's heavy and beautiful, you can sell it for a lot. You also need a bedroll if you think you're going to need something to sleep on, or another blanket in addition to whatever you're wearing on your body. You'll need your weapons, of course. You can't have a Dungeons & Dragons quest without weapons. A map is always important. Who has the map? Who's carrying it? That's important to remember. And you might have magic items like antidotes. In the Middle Ages, they really believed in such things, having stones that would prevent poison or that would give you a boost. These are very much true things that people had in the Middle Ages. And there are so many of them, I can't even get into them all right now. So that's something you can look up, gemology and the type of beliefs people had about stones. It's very historical and it's something that you can add to your game. But again, too many of those things to get into. How are you going to carry this all? Do you have a horse? Do you have a pack animal? Maybe you have a donkey with you. Do you have a cart? Do you have a wagon? All of these things you have to take with you, and you have to think about how you can get across obstacles. So this sounds pretty obvious, but if you're a dungeon master, you can throw all sorts of obstacles in the way of your players that make it really difficult. Everything from a muddy day makes life a whole bunch more difficult for people in the real world and in your game. Okay, so let's talk about traps and tricks. So I have a few things that I think could be cool and useful to tell you about, whether you are a DM or you're a player. The biggest challenge in the real world, and I think something that could bring a lot of help to your games, is noise. And I do think this is something that's built into D&D. There's always rules for stealth, right? You do have to be aware of this, but noise is something that is very much a part of life that maybe we don't always think about when we're projecting ourselves back into the past. Back in the real Middle Ages, there wasn't a lot of white noise. So that traffic noise that is constant day and night in a city was not constant in the Middle Ages. You might have a lot of city noise during the day, but at night, there's usually a curfew and everybody is back at home. So you don't have that wagon noise. You don't have a lot that's going to cover your sounds if you're trying to do something stealthy in the city at night. You don't have the electric fans on computers or fridges or anything like that. So if you're sneaking up on someone in the countryside, you also don't have the white noise of electricity to disguise whatever you're doing. Most of the stuff you're carrying with you is made of wood or made of leather or made of metal, and none of these things are particularly quiet. They all have their own sounds to them. So you have to think about that. The shoes in the Middle Ages are A+ for stealth, but the weapons, the armor, the packs, the belts, all of these things make noise. So if you're a rogue, like I always was, you might consider your belt. What is it made of? Maybe you don't want to have an ostentatious linked metal belt with you because it's too clanky when you're trying to sneak up on someone. Maybe you'll have a very worn leather belt so it doesn't make a lot of noise. And maybe instead of having a leather pouch as your purse on your belt, you have a drawstring bag. That's going to be less useful when you're in a crowd because someone can just cut the strings and take your stuff. But if you're sneaking into someone's house in the nighttime, you might want to have a cloth drawstring bag as the place where you keep your tools. When I think about rogues, I always think about them picking locks and sneaking into places. And medieval locks did have tumblers many times. So the type of lock picking stuff that you'd have today for many locks, you might also have in the Middle Ages. So those tiny little tools that you use to move the tumblers are similar to the ones that a rogue would be using back in the D&D Middle Ages. When you think about noise and you think about stealth, the question is, if you're not just going to kind of brazen it out and roll for stealth, what are you going to do with your stuff? Are you going to leave it behind? Where are you going to leave it? Because it's hard for people to track down a criminal back in the day, so you always want to be careful of where you leave your stuff because it's easy to lift it and take it away from you. So think about your stuff. Always think about your stuff when you are creating a world for your players to play in, or if you're a player that is playing in that world. Coming back to the real Middle Ages and some sources that are kind of useful, Peter was talking about Le Jouvencel as one of his favorite books from last year. And Le Jouvencel is a book that I ended up reading and writing about for medieval warfare. And it has some really cool tips in it about how to be sneaky when you're raiding. And they were really, really considering noise as one of the things that any army is up against when they are trying to be sneaky. And one of the things that Jouvencel came up with, I think it was him that came up with it, although it might have been one of his compatriots, was to cover a bridge with manure so that people couldn't hear the horseshoes as the horses were crossing it in the night. So this is a really cool way you can use the environment to muffle your noise. If you're not just rolling for stealth with your die, you can use the environment like spreading manure over a bridge. Le Jouvencel is a book that is based on the life of a real dude, but it's turned into a romance. So it's possible that a real dude had actually covered a bridge with manure and actually made that work. A couple of the other cool tricks from that book include sawing a gate in half stealthily and patching it back up with wax so that when they made their attack during the day, the enemy would have no idea that the gate was already breached. So that's a cool thing that you might want to think about if you're trying to get around one of your DM's rules. You also have to be careful of moonlight. So not just noise, but light. And in Le Jouvencel, they talk about this quite a lot. How can you disguise yourself from being seen in the night? So one of Jouvencel's most important instructions is just wait until the moon sets. So if you are creating an environment in which you have to have people being stealthy, you might want to think about whether it's a moonlit night or a moonless night. And this is something that people thought about in the real Middle Ages as well. Ambush is something I talked about in terms of cities, but of course, ambush is something you need to think about when you are fighting a campaign. In the real world, we're in a medieval fantasy world like in D&D. So if you are creating an ambush, you want to create it in a bottleneck where it's hard for people to escape or go backwards. If you are setting up a fight position for yourself, you need to think about that. Is my flank covered? And again, where do I put my stuff? Where do I put my prisoners? And this is something that people had to think about quite a lot. So you can always look at records from Agincourt or perhaps Crécy and see how people dealt with this, how they deal with the strategy of placing themselves in a way that's going to protect their flank and especially prisoners and their stuff. Because we do know that people in the Middle Ages raided wagons and raided the treasures of people who were fighting while they were busy. So this is something that you could do as a DM. Keep your players distracted with something in the front and have bad guys sneak in and take their stuff in the back. Again, always think about your stuff because without those essential survival tools, you're not going to last very long. And speaking of stuff, talking about stuff a lot, you want to think about hordes. So when we think about hordes, it tends to be dragons or things like that in D&D, right? It's stashed in a cave or something like that. You find hordes of stuff, and usually they're pretty old. But we know that in the real Middle Ages, people were stashing stuff as well. So some of the stuff that tells us about Roman Britain, for example, is stuff that's been buried in the ground. And Mark Morris has this in his latest book as well, talking about treasures that were stored in the ground that people thought they were going to come back to when things settled down. So we have many, many examples of hordes that people find in the ground that tell us about a danger that was happening at the time. So this is great for the storytelling of D&D, where you have a hint in a hoard in the ground where people find really cool stuff, but it also kind of indicates a danger that's around. It doesn't have to be dragons. It could be other people. But we know this is something historical as well, which I think is interesting, if not cool. I wouldn't want to say cool because some of the hoards, well, usually people are burying gold and treasures because there's something awful going on. So some of the most important hoards that you find are ones buried by Jewish families in Germany during the Black Death, for example. So these hoards, I don't want to say that they're cool, but they do tell a story. And a lot of D&D is about storytelling. And so you can have hoards that not only tell you about perhaps a dragon, but also about human interactions or other dangers that are happening around them. Now, there are not a lot of booby traps in European literature from the Middle Ages, but there are booby traps in Arabic literature. So I will come back to one in a second that I think is pretty cool. In European literature, there's a lot of other world people, which I think is relevant to D&D. So you come across a lot of elves or fairies in Arthurian literature, perhaps. And there's a couple of things you need to remember. Well, first one is never fall asleep under a grafted tree because you're probably going to get carried away to the other world. It never goes well for people who fall asleep under grafted trees. So there's one thing. You also never want to make a promise or a bet with someone from the other world. That's always tricky. They take those things very seriously, and you may be captured for a very long time if you do that. You also don't want to eat their food or drink anything that they offer you. So these are opportunities that are at least historically correct in that they are from medieval literature, but they are opportunities that you can take to trap these players and make life difficult for them. You also never want to kill a white animal. So if you see a white animal in literature from the Middle Ages, especially a stag or a doe, you don't want to kill it. And if you kill it, bad things always happen to you. So never kill a white animal. And so this might be another trick that you can throw out there for your players is make a beautiful white animal appear when they're starving or something and see what happens to them. Elves or fairies are usually beautiful and tricky and very self-centered. And I think this is something that, again, I haven't read any of these D&D manuals for quite some time, but I think this is something that is consistent in those. If it's a beautiful elf or fairy, they're probably self-centered and untrustworthy. So I mentioned that we don't have a lot of booby traps in European literature in the Middle Ages, but there's a whole bunch of them that appear in a book called The Book of Charlatans, which describes traps and tricks from Syria and Egypt. And that kind of makes sense because Egyptians are known for having booby trap tombs, aren't they? I mean, this is probably a stereotype that I need to examine by listening to an Egyptian podcast about ancient Egypt. But booby traps are something that are associated with Egypt in legend. And so in this Book of Charlatans, they talk about different ways that you can avoid traps, mostly involving digging. But it's funny, these traps from this medieval book involve sand falling down on you or water rushing down on you. And so the advice is usually to dig. And one of the traps is also to have these kind of automatons that are like waving swords at you, something out of Indiana Jones. And again, the solution to that is to dig underneath and to like pull the chains off their mechanisms. That's how you disarm them. So digging apparently is the way to get around a booby trap in medieval Egypt or Syria. But one of the tricks that I thought was quite cool that they mention in this Book of Charlatans as well is one of the ways you can trick people is by getting them to kiss a poison Quran. So you can use poison or a sleeping drug and put it on this book so that you ask someone to swear something to you, swear to their honesty. And when they kiss the Quran, they fall into a sleep. And it's a cool passage in this book because it mentions that you have a mixture of henbane and poppy and opium, among other things, as your sleeping drug on this holy book. And all of these things are actually pretty scarily effective. So it's a trick that you can use that is based on, again, maybe not actual history, but something that's talked about in the Middle Ages, having a sleeping powder or concoction on something that someone is going to come into contact with. one of the last things that I wanted to mention is that poison rings seem to be something that people had back in the day. Who knows how often they were used, but there are archaeological examples of poison rings. So that is something that you can use perhaps as a DM or you can use as a player and cause some mischief if you are perhaps chaotic evil in the Middle Ages version of D&D. So hopefully this has been a fun episode for you. I know it's kind of bouncing all over the place, but it's kind of a stream of consciousness way of thinking about how you can use reality to inform something like Dungeons and Dragons if you're playing it. And this is something that I use a lot, this kind of thinking, creative thinking, tied with historical thinking when I'm helping people creating fiction. So when I talk about the Medieval Masterclass for Creators, which I talk about on a regular basis, the next one is starting January 14th, by the way. It's this type of thinking where I'm helping people who are creating stuff to borrow from history and help it to be more realistic in a way that's fun. This is kind of my jam, is why I'm talking about it. So if you're interested in the Medieval Masterclass for Creators, you can go to medievalmasterclass.com and you can take the course that's 6 weeks long. We do a class every Friday where we talk about something different. Or if you need something that's a bit cheaper and a little faster, you can take the express version where you have videos that tell you a little bit about all of the subjects, but you don't have the personal interaction where you can get my coaching with you. I hope you found this a fun episode, whether you are just somebody who is listening every week and loves this kind of medieval trivia, or you're a dungeon master or you're a fiction writer. Hopefully this has been fun for you and has given you some new ideas to start 2022 in a way that is hopefully a little bit more upbeat. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this year, Peter?
Well, we're starting out with some fun, some Viking fun, some Viking torture fun, that is.
Wow, that's not what I expected you to say.
A group of scholars have published an article in Speculum about Blood Eagle, the Blood Eagle, which is this infamous torture. These are people that study anatomy, and they figure that it is anatomically possible to rip a person's lungs out through their back.
Wow. Happy New Year. Everyone pick up the latest Speculum to see if you can actually pull someone's lungs out through their backs. Wow.
That's right. They go through it. There are challenges to doing it, especially if you want to keep the person alive.
Wow. This just gets better and better.
You know, like they have that and they talk about how they could do it and, you know, the instruments you need. So yeah, could be done.
Wow.
So maybe we shouldn't share this too widely with the wider public, but, you know.
Too late now.
Yeah. So we have the news on that. Plus, we have some kind of winter fun. We have a movie review of The Lion in Winter. So this is a famous 1960s, you know, Katharine Hepburn, Peter O'Toole. So you can read about that. Winter Fun in China, too, from Elizabeth Smith Rosser. And we also finally have a piece kind of looking at roles in the monasteries. What was the abbot and the prior and the cellar? Like, what did they all do? So we kind of take a look at that, like a quick guide.
Are you trying to step on my toes here?
That's right. Soon enough, I'll be talking about the business side of monasteries.
Oh, that's your wheelhouse.
That's right.
The lineup is great, except for the torture.
That's right. Monks rarely did torture, so.
That's not how to live like a monk. And I have not written How to Live Like a Viking, but if I do write that book, now I'll know. All right, thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. We have awesome stuff for patrons like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. And you get the personal satisfaction of helping medievalist.net's podcasters keep bringing you fun historical content, including yours truly. So thank you. For all the details, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from Snow to Jon Snow, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even get hold of the new How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.